This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Wednesday, June 30th. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, the process of redistricting is underway in Colorado. We'll get an overview from the League of Women Voters. A number of new bills to protect the rights of immigrants living in the state have been signed into law, and others sit on the governor's desk. We'll look at their legal implications. And finally, herbalist Brigitte Mars will tell us about all the benefits of roses. A BBC update and commentary from Jim Hightower are at the bottom of the hour. And then it's a special edition of A Public Affair. I'll be hosting a panel of experts to discuss wildfires and public safety. You can learn more about fire bans, forest management, and what is being done at the federal, state, and county level to protect citizens of Colorado. And you can send in your questions by emailing them to dj@kgnu.org. That's all still ahead this morning after these headlines from Jamie Sudler.
Voters in Boulder will soon be able to choose their mayor using ranked choice selection. And it will be easier for the county clerk and recorder to conduct that election now that Colorado Governor Jared Polis has signed a new bill into law. The Daily Camera reports that after voters approved the Our Mayor, Our Choice initiative, the clerk's office had doubts about its ability to run the election, but a bill sponsored by State Senator Steve Fenberg, Democrat of Boulder, among others, allows municipalities to use ranked choice voting in nonpartisan elections and mandates that the Secretary of State's office establish rules and systems to carry them out. Using the process, a voter ranks their selection for a candidate by preference, and if no candidate gets 50% of the vote, the lowest vote getter is eliminated, and the people who voted for that candidate will have their votes distributed to their second choice. Mirkala Wozniak, a spokesperson for the Boulder County Clerk and Recorder, told the Daily Camera that they will now have the support from the state to create a ranked choice system for the city of Boulder necessary for the election in 2023. Yesterday, rough drafts of maps redrawing state legislative district lines were presented to the Colorado Independent Legislative Redistricting Commission. While the maps are expected to change a lot over the next few months, they start the discussion over how political lines should be drawn. For the first time ever in Colorado, the redistricting process is being conducted by two independent commissions. It's also the first time the addresses of incumbent politicians will not be considered. The first maps show some incumbents placed in the same districts. The new maps are based on estimates of the census due to the delay in the final release of data collected last year. The Colorado Sun identified various districts that contain two incumbents, including District 7, which has both Democratic Senator Sonia Jaquez-Lewis of Longmont and Republican Senator Barbara Kirkmeyer of Brighton, both of whom are up for re-election in 2024. Democratic Representatives Edie Hooten and Judy Amabile, both of Boulder, are included in House District 37. As the process continues and the federal government releases final numbers from the 2020 census, the maps are likely to be modified. And we'll have more on redistricting after headlines. The city of Denver is conducting sweeps of homeless encampments much faster this year than last. The Denver Post reports that advocates for those experiencing homelessness are worried and that the clearings come as the city prepares for the All-Star Baseball game on July 13th. City officials will conduct more sweeps by tomorrow than it did in all of 2020, according to Councilmember Candy Sitabaca's office. The cleanups picked up in April when Major League Baseball announced the game would be moved to Denver. However, the Post reports that it's unclear whether the increase is connected to the game, warmer weather, or the waning pandemic. However, Sitabaca said the baseball game is a perfect excuse for the city to clean up its image, with the whole purpose being to improve or erase the aesthetic of poverty in order to drive commerce. According to data collected by Sitabaca's office, the city is averaging more than 8 sweeps a month this year compared to the average of more than just 4 a month last year. As of tomorrow, residents of Denver will have to pay 10 cents for a grocery bag if they don't take their own to the store. The new provision includes all retail stores, department stores, liquor, and hardware stores. The Denver Right reports that over 100 million disposable bags are used in the city each year, with only 5% recycled. Individuals on federal food assistance programs like SNAP or EBT will also be exempt from paying the fee. Schools across Colorado whose mascots are based on Native American names or images will have to change them after the governor signed a bill earlier this week. The law imposes a $25,000 per month fine on schools that continue to use Native imagery or names. An estimated 24 schools across the state still use this kind of imagery. As an example, Colorado Public Radio reports that Grand Junction's Central High School will have to change its mascot from a Native American, but will keep the name Warriors. Schools have until June 2022 to comply with the new law or risk being fined. Yesterday, the Colorado Department of Transportation closed Interstate 70 through Glenwood Canyon because of the potential of more mudslides. The closure was lifted at about 8:20 p.m. after 2.5 hours. CDOT said the closure was due to a flash flood warning for the area burned last year in the Grizzly Creek wildfire. Last weekend, the highway was shut down twice because of two separate slides. CDOT has warned that closures could happen again if rain continues in the mountains. And in the weather today, skies will be partly sunny with highs around 80, with a chance of showers and thunderstorms afternoon. Tomorrow about the same, with an increase in the likelihood of an afternoon shower or thunderstorm. Right now it's about 61 in Boulder and a bit warmer in Denver and Fort Collins. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU, 88.5 FM and 1390 AM. As mentioned in the headlines, Colorado's Independent Redistricting Commission has released its proposed state Senate and state congressional maps. This comes ahead of a summer roadshow of public hearings seeking input and comment. For more on the redistricting process, we're joined live by Beth Momskog, mathematician with the League of Women Voters. Welcome, Beth.
Thanks for having me here, Shannon.
Let's start with the basics. Why is Colorado undergoing a redistricting process now, and what is it designed to do?
Well, every state in the country is also undergoing a redistricting process now. It happens every 10 years after the census. And the idea is that to get fair representation, we need to have districts that are of equal sizes, and we need to reapportion the seats to the states based on the changes in population in the last 10 years. So after the 2020 census, it's time to rearrange the districts to make sure that everybody gets equal representation. So in Colorado, we're redrawing our congressional districts, and we've gotten an 8th congressional district in the reapportionment, which is very exciting. And we're also redrawing our state Senate and state House districts right now.
Tell listeners about amendments Y and Z and how they change the way redistricting is done here.
Yeah, so in 2018, Colorado passed amendments Y and Z to the Constitution, which fundamentally changed how redistricting happens. These two amendments appoint 12 member commissions, for one for the congressional districts and one for the state house and state senate districts, that will be in charge of deciding the maps with a lot of input from the public. So right now those commissions have been seated, and there was a long process that went into that to try and make sure that there was really transparency and that we got a sort of diverse and representative set of commissions. And those commissions have been meeting all summer, and the Legislative Council, which is the nonpartisan staff that serves the legislature, have now drawn some preliminary maps. Last week they released the maps for the Congress, and this week they released the state legislative maps just yesterday. Now these are preliminary maps, and so what's gonna happen is that the commissions are now gonna take these maps on the road and get public input on, you know, what do people like, what do people not like about these, find out about people's communities of interest that might be divided or that they would like to have preserved, and really just get a lot of public input on these preliminary maps. And then there'll be a process of redrawing and potentially another redrawing before the final maps are approved by the commissions.
And how can the public find out more about these proposed maps and learn about the process and participate in the input?
Yeah, so one website is redistricting.colorado.gov. This is the official website of the commissions, and it's great. They have so much information there. The new maps are posted and you can read all of their rationales for why they made the choices that they did. There's a lot of information that you can find out about the commissioners, and you can find out the full schedule of public meetings there. So I think this is a great website. You could also visit us over at the League of Women Voters. Our website's lwvcolorado.org. And we have set up an observer corps. So if you're interested in going to these meetings and really, or hearing what our observer corps has found out by going to these meetings and sort of reporting back, you can check that out at the League of Women Voters Colorado website.
And finally, how can the way Colorado is now carrying out redistricting be a model for other states?
Yes. Yeah, so in many states, most states, though it's changing a little bit more recently, this redistricting is done by the state legislature, meaning that whatever party is in charge in the state legislature can sometimes determine, you know, who benefits from the maps that they draw. And so, sorry, I forgot what I was saying there for a second.
How Colorado could be a model.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so this is clearly not ideal. And so Colorado's Amendments Y and Z have given us an opportunity to really do something special and draw these maps in a way that other states can watch and, you know, see how our process goes. And if this process goes well and we're successful in drawing maps that people are excited about and that people feel are fair, then other states will then have sort of a template for how they might be able to change their redistricting process in the future. And Colorado is very proud of this.
Beth Momskog of the League of Women Voters, thanks for coming on the program this morning.
Thanks. Great to talk with you, Shannon.
And after the break, we'll be back with an interview with Marissa Molina of Forward.us. You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. The state legislative session that wrapped up this month witnessed the passage of several bills supported by immigrants' rights organizations. Last Friday, Governor Jared Polis signed 4 pro-immigrant bills into law, and several others are on his desk. Joining me to discuss some of these bills is Marissa Molina, Colorado State Director of Forward.us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So first, can you give listeners a quick overview of some of the standout bills from this legislative session?
Yeah, absolutely. So on Friday, the governor signed into law 4 key immigration bills that will make a really big impact for immigrants. But as you mentioned, there's also other bills that have already been signed and those that are to be signed that will also have a good impact on our immigrant community. Particularly on Friday, Governor Polis signed Senate Bill 131, which protects folks' data privacy and ensures that the personal identifiable information that they share with state agencies isn't weaponized for immigration enforcement. He also repealed anti-immigrant laws that were passed in the special session in 2006, which is a really big deal. And it was the hard work and organizing of folks from the Colorado Parent Coalition. And then we also worked on a bill, Senate Bill 77, which eliminates the lawful presence requirement to allow individuals who meet the education and qualification requirements to access professional licenses and certificates under the Department of Regulatory Agency and the Colorado Department of Education. So, you know, just 3 among some really great bills. There was also the creation of the Office of New Americans, which will continue to exist within the state government. And that is important because that will continue to center how do we create a Colorado where really everyone can thrive regardless of their immigration status.
And what kind of organizing efforts took place to really push for these changes and to get these bills across the finish line?
Yeah, you know, I worked really closely on Senate Bill 131, which was the one around data privacy. And we were working in coalition with over 20 partner organizations across the state of Colorado under the iDrive Coalition and with our partners at the Colorado Immigrant Rights Coalition. So, you know, we'd been hearing for a really long time that folks had this concern in the community that the information they were giving, particularly to the DMV to be able to access a driver's license, was being utilized by ICE to detain and deport people. And so the iDrive Coalition led this big investigation that uncovered hundreds of emails of communications between the Colorado DMV and ICE officers. And they were sharing back information about people. And there really wasn't a process in which, you know, agencies were vetting these types of requests for people's information. And so the organizing really started last year when coalition partners came together with the governor's office to really discuss this issue. And last year, in May of 2020, the governor issued guidance to put in place some measures to protect people's personal identifiable information. And what we did was say, how do we make sure that that guidance is codified and strengthened into law so that it does not matter who is in office, but that becomes the law of Colorado, that people's personal identifiable information is protected. It is also so important to talk about the directly impacted individuals that oftentimes are fully undocumented, who came forward during the legislative hearings, who reached out to their legislators one-on-one to share why these bills, you know, would make such a big difference. So we can't do the work as advocates if we don't have the voices of directly impacted people leading. And I know that was the case for many of the other bills that I mentioned, is that the folks who were at the forefront of telling the stories of why these policies needed to be passed were the folks who were experiencing the most harm because these protections weren't in place.
And in addition to this data privacy bill, you also have specific insights into another bill that was passed having to do with professional licensing requirements. Can you give some details about that?
Yeah, so before in Colorado statute, it said that somebody needed to have lawful presence to be able to have a professional license or access a professional certificate. Well, this was a barrier even for folks with deferred action for childhood arrivals or DACA or people with TPS, which is temporary protected status, because those folks have, again, temporary protections, but they're not given a lawful status. And so even though they had work authorization, they were not able to access so many of these licenses to be able to, you know, go out into the workforce. So even if they were going to school, you know, I met so many students who were going to school for counseling, for example, they weren't able to access a counseling license under the state of Colorado because of that language. And so what Senate Bill 77 did is that it removed that lawful presence requirement. So as long as people meet the education requirements, as well as the other like testing requirements that are in place by the Colorado regulatory agency, as well as the Colorado Department of Education, then people are able to access a license under those departments. And so that is a really big deal because this opens the door of opportunity for so many different careers for people who before this were locked out of them. Careers such as nursing, engineering, financial advising. You need that license to be an electrician, a plumber, an esthetician. All of these folks who, you know, maybe could start their own businesses. 90 days from when it was signed, it'll start to take effect. And so that'll be a really important thing for our community to be aware of, is that now there's access to all these different opportunities.
There's a type of glass ceiling when you have these barriers to any kind of job. But it's interesting that so many DACA recipients in other states tend to go into public service jobs. Now, I understand that this is a very subjective question, but just in your opinion, what do you see as the link between this tendency to seek out public service jobs among people with DACA status?
You know, from my experience, having talked to so many DACA recipients and dreamers across the state of Colorado, really comes down to one thing. And that is the belief that somebody has invested in us, whether that's been somebody in our community, a teacher, a counselor, somebody in our church, somebody has invested in us. We have been the recipients of the goodwill of our community of individuals. And we want to be able to, you know, folks want to be able to contribute that back to say, I know what it took for me to get here. I know who it took for me to get here. And I want to make sure that other people have that same and equal opportunity to achieve and to access, you know, their full potential.
And zooming out from Colorado to look at federal measures, because, of course, immigration law is federal law, what is going on at the congressional level when it comes to comprehensive immigration reform?
That's a great question, Shannon. So earlier this year, in March, the House passed the H.R. 6, the Dream and Promise Act, which would provide a pathway to citizenship, not just for current DACA recipients, but a broader Dreamer population. And then it also passed the Farm Worker Modernization Act, which would provide a pathway to citizenship for farm workers who've been on the front lines during the pandemic, right, making sure America is fed. And those have been two really incredible, momentous bills, because for a long time, Congress hadn't passed any affirmative legislation on immigration. Currently, those two pieces of legislation have not made it to the floor of the U.S. Senate. And so we continue to call on Congress, to call on our senators to support these measures. We've had strong support from the Colorado delegation on both of these measures and support for Dreamers. And as we have seen with other pieces of legislation, it's really about meeting that vote threshold count. And so we continue to really stress the importance of reaching across the aisle, of having bipartisan conversations around how do we solve this really big issue that's been happening for decades without any real solutions. And so we've been really focused on that. How do we work with folks across the aisle to make sure that that happens, because we know that this year is the year to take action.
And how hopeful are you that this year will be the year that change happens?
You know, I feel really hopeful. And as somebody who has had DACA, as somebody who grew up undocumented in Colorado, I can't lose that hope, because I know that that hope is what has anchored so many of our families in continuing this fight. And so hope will be the last thing I lose. But I will also say that we've seen some really positive statements come from President Biden, from other congressional leaders, about their commitment to do what is necessary to ensure that we have some real solutions coming out of this year when it comes to immigration. And so we're ready to work with the folks who want to come to the table to create meaningful, common sense solutions around immigration. And we're also ready to hold folks accountable to those commitments that they have made to the community.
Marissa Molina, immigrant rights organizer, Colorado State Director of Forward.us, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Greetings and welcome to Naturally. This is Brigitte Mars. It is such a delight to see and smell all the beautiful roses that are blooming right now. So what's the deal with roses? Well, we know they're gorgeous and smell fantastic, but the rose family, or Rosaceae family, is a huge family that includes many of our fruits that we enjoy. Things like apples, peaches, pears, plums, cherries, strawberries, and almonds are all in the Rosaceae family. The genus name Rosa comes from the Latin meaning red. So roses have a long history of being used medicinally. The flowers, when made into a tea, are pain-relieving, antimicrobial, an antidepressant, anti-inflammatory, and of course, an aphrodisiac. But we certainly do not want to use commercial roses that have been perhaps sprayed with all kinds of poisons that may be grown in another country, with some of the poisons that we have banned being shipped to other countries. So think about growing your own roses or supporting righteous flower growers at your local farmers market. So we know that rose flowers, when made into a tea, break up congestion, dry mucus, help to calm the heart, the emotional heart, enhance positive emotions, regulate the menstrual cycle, and even help conditions like anxiety and depression. So you can eat rose petals. Again, they have to be organic, but I never put a whole rose on someone's plate because that's just too much. But if you break the roses up and use the petals strategically to make a design on a salad or a cake, they are so beautiful. It makes your guests feel really special. You can also freeze rose petals by filling an ice cube tray halfway with some rose petals in it, and then after it freezes, fill it the rest of the way with water, because the rose petals will float to the top. So after the rose flowering season, then we get the fruit of the rose hip. And rose hips are very rich in something called flavonoids that help to strengthen the capillaries. They also improve the assimilation of vitamin C. You may have bought a vitamin C before and it says, with rose hips. So here's a gift that can help you assimilate vitamin C better. And rose hips have a seed inside that is used in the cosmetic industry, which is really good for helping to promote the healing of damaged skin. We know that rosehip seed is high in vitamin E. So roses are a universal symbol of beauty and love. White roses symbolize innocent love, but red roses symbolize passionate love. Pink roses, simple and happy love. And yellow roses, just friendship. You might put some thought into what kind of roses you grow or give away. Thanks for joining me, Brigitte Mars, on Naturally.
And that does it for The Morning Magazine. Thank you for joining us.